You know, artificial intelligence is an interesting term. There is no intelligence. It doesn't have common sense. It just has math. We give the systems identities. We treat them like friends. We give them names, and they have nice voices thanks to digital technology. But we get kind of lulled into a false sense of security.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. I'm very excited about the topic today, which is going to be maybe a step beside our typical sales talk, but very relevant for anybody, whether you're in sales, an entrepreneur, a coach. If you're operating in the business world today, you are impacted, affected, have heard of, used already AI technology, perhaps even more specifically ChatGPT in some capacity. So we're going to have an episode that's going to be speaking about this, but not only about the cool hacks, the things that maybe are magical to use it, but also an understanding of how it's actually changing the global economy. And this is going to be something we need to pay attention to on how it's going to shape the way that we live our lives, how companies operate, and so much more. And it's such an honor to have Jim Rickards, who's going to be joining me today. If you're not familiar with him, the man has written extensively in publications you might have heard of, Telegraph, New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, Evening Standard. He's been a lecturer in globalization finance at the Johns Hopkins University, Georgetown, Trinity, Dublin, the Kellogg School at Northwestern. And the list goes on. But on top of that, the man has published so many amazing books that are so relevant to the times, such as The New Great Depression, The Aftermath, The Road to Ruin, all these books related to what is happening in the global economy. And his latest book, which is going to be available for pre-sales right now, which is Money GPT. You need to have a look at this. You're going to see it's either out by the time you're listening to this episode or just on the days before its release. And you're going to want to create a copy once you hear the conversations on why it's so relevant. Jim, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be with you and with your audience. Looking forward to it.
Now, Jim, this is an interesting time. You know, we're recording this actually just before the US elections. There's things going on around the world. There's new technology emerging. And to be honest, we look at AI, ChatGPT, and for most people that have had like a touch with them, it's one of the nice things that have come out recently. It's made my life a little easier. And I think that we don't fully grasp what changes is happening on the foundation of the world, aside from the little hacks and cool tricks we've been able to use as consumers, which I think is why your book comes at an important time. And there's a message that most people probably don't even realize. So I'd be curious to know what excited you and prompted you to put this book together.
Sure, Jason. And you're right. Well, sure, your listeners are hearing enough about the U.S. election. We don't have to touch on that at all. I'm happy to say this book, Money GPT, is not a political book. It's a book of the times. Artificial intelligence is here. GPT is here. So I talk about how it could play out and some of the benefits and some of the dangers. But it's not a futuristic book. Oh, this will all be here in 2 or 3 years. It's here now. It's everywhere you go. When you open your refrigerator and there's a little light that says, you know, you need to change the water filter, that's artificial intelligence. That's sort of monitoring it and saying, well, time's up, you know, and giving you a message. And it's already here. That's the first point I would make. The second thing, you know, as I'm sure you know, the book business, you know, this is my ninth book, and it bears a more close resemblance to kind of the 19th century than the 21st century. I'm sure you'll be familiar with to Charles Dickens in the sense that, by the way, I guess I need a disclaimer. I actually wrote the book. I did not use GPT to write the book for me. But the writing of the book, the research that goes into it, you know, and then you shape it up and you're bouncing back and forth, editors, copy editors. I love copy editors. They're the ones who do the semicolons and commas. I just keep writing. I let them figure that out. They do a great job. And then you got to print it. Well, you got to send it, box it, ship it, you know, et cetera. It takes, I mean, some authors work on a book for 5 years, but it takes me anywhere from, you know, 18 months, almost 2 years to do it from start to finish. So one of the questions your publisher has, and I have a very good relationship with Penguin Random House, have been very good to me. They say, well, Jim, sounds like a great idea, but how do we know when the book actually comes out, meaning a year or a year and a half, that this is still going to be a hot topic? I said to my editor, Nikki, I promise you this will be hotter when the book comes out than it is right now. This is not going away. And that turns out to be the case. AI is, I mean, among other things, AI stocks are driving the stock market. Now, AI stocks are, you know, companies, they're hardware companies, software companies, et cetera. We all know the names, you know, the Magnificent Seven or the Fabulous Five, whatever you want to call them. So independent of the technology, which is everywhere, the AI concept or theme, if you will, narrative is probably a better word, is driving the stock market to the moon. So it is all around us. The book is not a doom and gloom book. I say right up front, this is very powerful technology. It's here. It can do a lot of good. You just have to acknowledge that. I mean, there have been a couple of cases where AI has identified an assembly of molecules that could cure a disease. Now you're saying, well, can't people do that? Well, the answer is, you put a lot of smart people in a room and keep them there for years. They cannot process as many correlations as a computer can, a high-powered computer with the right chips can do in a matter of minutes, you know, if not hours. And the point being, it's not about IQ points. It's about the processing power. And if you're looking at, you know, millions of compounds and, you know, an exponentially larger amount of combinations, humans cannot identify them, at least not in any reasonable period of time, and computers can. So that's the good side of it. And, you know, we should all applaud that. But it's been a little too much, you know, rah, 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 you know, stocks higher, AI's here, you know, $100 billion plus valuations to some of these companies. I don't think enough thought has been given to some of the dangers. And again, I'm not bashing it. I'm more in the warning business than the doom and gloom business. I'm saying we all need to think about certain aspects of this that have not been given enough thought that could be extremely detrimental to markets and national security. And those are kind of my lanes. Obviously, been in the markets, whether it's banking, investment banking, hedge funds, stock exchanges for decades. I happen to be a lawyer, but I've always worked, you know, kind of in-house in the business. I know it very well. And then I've done quite a bit on the national security side with the Department of Defense, the intelligence community. And I've advised, you know, I've spoken to, you know, Ben Bernanke and Fed governors and Tim Geithner and Treasury officials, et cetera. So I've got that national security side. So I'm not, other than mentioning it in passing, I'm not talking about cures for diseases. I'm not talking about a lot of other things that AI might be able to do. It's really finance and national security, but very much focused on those and some of the dangers.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see the progress. Of course, I think a lot of people might have ridden the bandwagon with that. I mean, you're seeing all these stocks that are going crazy, and any company that adds the word AI in their value proposition suddenly gets more funding. Isn't that a wonderful thing? But there's obviously these risks. And one of the things I might want to address, which might be a slightly outside of your lane, but very relevant to the majority of the listeners here, is do you address a lot of the consumer or individual risks? Or when you speak about the money GPT, are we talking things that are going to be in the financial markets exclusively?
Well, I make the point, it's a great question, Jason. I make the point that some of the concepts might be a little macro. I'm not saying they're difficult to understand. In fact, I work with multiple Nobel Prize winners in economics and very immersed in the economics world. They love jargon. They love equations. They love advanced calculus. But I've never seen, and I understand it, but I've never seen anything that you couldn't put into plain English. And so I try to steer away from the, you know, kind of trying to write something that nobody except a few experts can understand. I understand it, but I can say, I guess I can just put it in plain English, and that's one of my specialties. But the point being, if capital markets writ large are a problem, individuals are affected. In other words, you don't have to be, I always say when it comes to your own money, everybody has a PhD. People tend to be very focused on their personal well-being. And if markets are closed, I don't mean crashing or down 30%. I mean, close, and I'll explain how that could happen. Then you, as an individual, you're affected. Your 401k, which you thought you could buy and sell and cash out when you're 70 years old or whatever, suddenly becomes private equity. It doesn't mean your property has been stolen. It does mean that you can't cash it out, you can't spend it, and you can't sell it. That's what happens when markets actually close. And so, you know, are there big concepts here? Yes, and I explain them very clearly, but they do affect individuals. I think the linkage that you're pointing to is there. I can give a very specific example. There's something economists, behavioralists are very familiar with it. The idea has been around for a while. It's called the fallacy of composition. It's a fancy name, but what is that? And the idea is some action that makes sense for an individual, make perfect sense for you or me or any of your viewers to do, that works, actually fails and is catastrophic when done on a large scale. And those things that make sense at the individual scale can be catastrophic at a large scale. I'll give you a very simple example, and then we can tie it back to capital markets. So let's say you're at a baseball game. Your seats aren't great, and you can't see quite as well as you would like, so you stand up. Well, now you have a better view. You're standing up. Hey, I can see the game perfectly. What happens next? Well, the person behind you stands up, and the person behind her stands up, and so on. And next thing you know, everybody in the stadium is on their feet, and nobody's better off. In fact, everybody's worse off because you're standing. So a thing that makes sense for the individual, leave aside whether it's selfish or not, it's just behavioral. A thing that makes sense for the individual can be catastrophic on a large scale. Now, let's apply that to the stock market. So let's say stocks are going down for 100 reasons. It doesn't matter. There's always something. And you're sitting there as an individual and you're trying to decide what to do. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It was March 2020. Stock market crashed 30% in 1 month. Now it came back and it's at higher levels. I understand that. But it did crash 30% in 1 month. And so what should people do? Well, a lot of people say, you know what? I don't know what's going on. I can't control the pandemic. I'm going to sell everything, go to cash, move to the sidelines, wait until I get more clarity, and then I'll tiptoe back into the market and, you know, catch the next wave. That's a perfectly sensible thing to do. But what if everybody does it? All of a sudden, on a macro level, you have all sellers, no buyers, no liquidity, and markets aren't just going down. They're crashing. They're blowing through circuit breakers. Circuit breakers are timeout. The New York Stock Exchange will close the exchange for 15 minutes, give everybody time to regroup, you know, call your friends, whatever, and then reopen it. But then just boom, hits the next circuit breaker, boom, third one, close for the day. If it spreads from New York to Tokyo to Singapore to Mumbai, all of a sudden, are we closing every market in the world? Well, by the way, we came extremely close to exactly that outcome on September 28th, 1998, during the depths of the long-term capital management crisis. And I actually negotiated the bailout for the crisis. I was the lawyer for LTCM, long-term capital management. I was on the phone with the Fed and CEO of Goldman Sachs. And I was trying to get 2 hours sleep. Everyone else was working around the clock. I was trying to get 2 or 3 hours sleep because I had to make decisions and put my head down the pillow. 3 o'clock, the phone rings. It's the Italian Ministry of Finance because we were the largest traders in Italian government bonds. They wanted to know what was going on. I talked to them. My wife said, you talked for 30 seconds and went right back to sleep. But my point is, we got the deal done, $4 billion, all cash, 72 hours, no due diligence. It was one of the, you know, Wellington said, a very close run thing. But if we had failed, if we hadn't done that, every market in the world would have closed, at least for a few days until they sorted things out. So my point is, that's one of the problems I point to, which is a thing that makes sense for an individual could be catastrophic on a large scale. Now, how does that relate to AI? Because that behavior I described, it's like any panic. They've been around forever. Well, what we're doing is more and more, we're letting AI make the decisions for us. We're programming AI to trade portfolios. There were a couple of hedge funds out there that have said, we just, you know, we keep an eye on things, but we don't actually make the decisions. We let AI pick the stocks. And some of them in the very early going have been successful. Like AI turns out to be a pretty good stock picker. And you can debate whether individuals are as good. That works fine in the early going, and it works fine when you're not in a panic situation. But how do you program AI to deal with the situation I just described? Well, you have human engineers. They may be great engineers. They may be great coders. They may understand deductive logic. But do they understand markets? You've got to be in markets a long time to really pick up on the psychology. And they collaborate with, you know, you'll get a top investment manager and a top engineer, and they'll work together and try to program this. But what do they actually program? They program exactly what I said. They say, yeah, in a tough situation, sell, you know, maybe not sell everything at once, sell in stages, keep selling, go to cash, go to the sidelines, and wait for it to come back. So we've engineered the behavior that's good for an individual that will be catastrophic on a large scale. And you know, you go back to the old days, I'm talking 80s, maybe it was over by the 90s, I guess. The New York Stock Exchange used to have a system called the specialist system. And if you were a specialist, you got a privilege and a duty at the same time. Your privilege was you got to see the back of the book. You knew, you know, the market had a bid offer, but, you know, what are the deeper bids and the higher offers to say? You had that information, which was a kind of legal inside information. But your duty was to stand up to the market. If everybody was a seller, you were supposed to be a buyer and kind of stabilize the market a little bit. Or if everyone was a buyer in a frenzy, maybe you're a little bit of a seller. You were supposed to calm the markets down or equilibrate a little bit. That system is long gone. I talked to a friend of mine. He's still on the floor. He was the head of floor operations for the New York Stock Exchange. We were down on the floor, actually pretty tight security. And he said to me, he said, Jim, don't let anyone ever tell you there's any liquidity down here. There isn't. I mean, we do our jobs. Looks good on TV. We can make money, but we're not going to save the market. And, you know, those days are long gone. So on the one hand, we're handing it over to computers. We're using AI specifically. And on the other hand, the human element, you could call it, you know, common sense, gut instinct, you know, do the opposite, contrarian, whatever, is gone. And so now you're in a very, very vulnerable, fragile situation where the markets could just go straight down, blow through the circuit breakers, and get to a point where you actually have to shut the markets, maybe not permanently. Very few people know the New York Stock Exchange was closed from August to December 1914. At the outbreak of World War I. There's a long story behind that. I mean, what actually happened is people went down, they would take out classified ads in the newspapers. This is, you know, say 1914. They said, meet me on the street behind the New York Stock Exchange. Bring your paper certificates or bring cash and we'll meet and we'll. And so they were trading stocks on the street. They called it the curb market because you were standing on the curb waving your stock certificates. So, you know, humans are very adaptive. They find a way, but I think that would come as a shock to most 401k holders. That's one example. It's real. It is how AI is being used. And the difference, you're like, okay, Jim, got it, but why isn't that just another panic? Well, the answer is the speed. The speed at which this happens is exponentially greater. We've all seen grainy black and white photographs from the 1930s of people, mostly men, you know, in overcoats and fedoras, standing in the rain, lined up around a bank to get their money out of the bank. And of course, if you were in that line, it was too late because the insiders had already taken the money. But now, what do? You just get on your iPhone, you hit a few keys, you move the money out of the bank or sell your stocks, and then you text your friends and say, hey, get out fast, it's all coming down.
But I was going to even stack on that is that don't most people already have like their automatic system programmatic that if it hits a certain threshold, it automatically triggers and the entire, every single person is on that system. So now it's like some marker goes into some unpredicted territory. It's like, boom, a bunch of algorithm triggers at the same time. And it's like,
That's exactly right. There's called, you know, stop loss or, you know, limit order stop losses. You're exactly right. And yeah, you don't even have to get your iPhone out. It's happening at the speed of light.
So then when there's no liquidity, like there's nothing that happens. By the way, you're talking about a very, very unfamiliar person when it comes to investing in the stock market. I'm a real estate guy. So just know I will ask the stupid questions.
Well, it's a good question. And the answer is it could be any, we're talking about stocks because you know, that affects a lot of people. They have their 401ks and their IRAs and all that. But any market, and it could be real estate. Sometimes it is, by the way, as you know. But whether it's stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities, whenever you're in a state where there are all sellers and no buyers, it evaporates. It's gone. And two things happen. Initially, prices just drop. They just fall to the floor. But then eventually regulators step in and they close the markets. So, okay, no muss, you know, timeout. When do they reopen? Well, you know, usually what happens is that people who didn't get out in time, you're right, the computers will take care of it for a lot of people until it shuts down. That's the feedback loop. That's what happens. But for those who didn't get out, they're like the people lined up around the bank in the 1930s. The minute you reopen, they're going to stop. So you're just going to shut it down again. Then you get into other scenarios. You know, well, okay, does the federal government have to nationalize the banks to restore confidence? Well, maybe yes, that's happened time and time again. And is there one bank big enough to withstand this? Well, maybe JP Morgan, but if the thing gets, you know, what is JP Morgan going to own the entire banking system? Well, that's no different than nationalizing. And so you do get into those scenarios. I mean, there are a lot of them, and I talk a little bit about them, but mainly I'm talking about how you get there, how you get to that dead end. And the way it happens, it's really a combination of automation and human nature. Human nature hasn't changed in probably 50,000 years, but I'll say 5,000 years of civilization. But when you combine that with automation in a feedback loop where it's all happening faster than people can contemplate, that's new. And the role of artificial intelligence is basically, you know, artificial intelligence is an interesting term. There is no intelligence. That's another mistake people make, and I talk about this in the book. It's called, I'll give you the big word, and then we'll put it in plain English, anthropomorphization, which means basically we give human characteristics to inanimate or non-human objects. You know, people love their pets, they love their dogs, and pretty soon the dogs are being treated like children. There's a little bit of that. Winnie the Pooh is a harmless childhood storybook where we think Winnie's our best friend, and you know, Winnie's an imaginary bear. But that's okay. You know, we want to stimulate the imagination. We want children to think things like that. But when it comes to technology, I'll pick on Siri and Alexa as examples, but there are many others. They're all over the place. They talk to you. That's GPT, by the way, generative pre-trained transformer technology with voice recognition or text-to-voice capabilities, et cetera. So your systems talk to you, and I tend not to use them. I once smashed an Alexa with a sledgehammer. I ordered something from Amazon. Amazon's very good. I shop there all the time. But whatever, I clicked the wrong box, and they sent me an Alexa. It's like an extra thing. And I did. I keep sledgehammers for certain purposes. I took it out in the driveway and smashed it because I didn't know what else to do with it. But people love them, and family members and friends who have them. And they'll be sitting there. We'll be having a drink. And they'll say, Alexa, turn down the lights. And she will. Or Alexa, turn on the music. And it does. I mean, they function perfectly. They're also listening to you 24/7. And Alexas are talking to other Alexas in the neighborhood, you know, profiling behavior, getting ready to call the cops. That's a separate topic.
Whoa.
Well, that's true. But we tend to treat them as our best friends, which is a mistake because they're not our friends. They're just systems, number one. And they don't have calm, soothing voices. It's all math. There's no brain in there. It's all math. And once you understand that, and again, I talk about this in the book, you can begin to see some of the dangers that I'm talking about. And, you know, could, now I'll give you a hypothetical. I don't know that this has happened, but it easily could happen. Could the government, you know, working with Google, intervene and get every Alexa in the country to do something that the government wants to do, you know, turn off the lights because there's a blackout or who knows what. But the point is, we've networked and wired ourselves into a situation where we're treating all this AI as, you know, friendly and, you know, congenial. And I have a scenario in the book. The book is nonfiction, of course, but it helps sometimes to create a scenario to help lead the reader through the kinds of problems we're talking about. And I do that. But I have a couple of characters with names that are AI. But the trader, and one guy runs a family office, another guy's a market manipulator, but they're talking to their AI assistants as if it was just another, you know, administrative assistant or trader, or sales trader, whatever, saying, hey, you know, do this, do that. And the computers are talking to each other. Orders are being entered into Goldman Sachs, and there's no human on the other side. They're just getting done, but it leads to these kind of outcomes.
You know, I find you're brave here, Jim. You know, talk about smashing Alexa. If AI becomes sentient, you're going to be the first one they hunt down here. Like, you've hurt one of their own. But, like, even that statement speaks of the personification we have around AI and how there's, like, a point where you're like, hey, we got to be nice to them because when they come sentient, you know, I want to be a good pet, not a murdered person.
That's right. And when I smashed it, she was not plugged in, so I don't think she felt any pain, but...
Okay, good. That's the compassionate way to destroy things.
But humans are very prone to this. That's part of our comfort level. We give the systems identities. We treat them like friends. We give them names, and they have nice voices thanks to digital technology. But we get kind of lulled into a false sense of security. The other area I talk a lot about, Jason, is I mentioned national security. And that's a really interesting one. And I focus on nuclear war fighting. That's a subject I started studying in the late 60s. And a lot of the scholarly work on that was done in the late 50s and the early 60s. So it was pretty fresh stuff. You know, this is during the Cold War. And, you know, the thought leaders were Paul Nitz, Roberto Wolfstetter, Albert Wolfstetter, Henry Kissinger, and the big brain was Herman Kahn. And Herman Kahn came up with a way of understanding nuclear war fighting. Nobody wakes up and says, hey, nice day, I think I'll shoot off a nuclear missile. That's not how it happens. It happens through escalation. Somebody provokes somebody, the other side pushes back, they push back some more, and you're climbing a ladder, you're climbing an escalatory ladder. And the top of the ladder is nuclear annihilation and the end of the human race. So two things to understand. Number one, that is the dynamic. We saw it in the Cuban Missile Crisis and a few other examples I talk about in the book. The other one is, what do you do about that? And I don't want to dive into politics, but when I look at Ukraine, you know, you can take sides, do the history, whatever, but it is on an escalatory path. The 2014 Maidan Revolution, the U.S. overthrew a properly elected president. We didn't like him, but we did overthrow him. You know, Russia takes Crimea. The U.S. sends weapons. Russia invades Donbass. The U.S. sends long-range missiles. Next thing you know, things are blowing up in Russia. Again, you don't have to take sides. Just understand that you're on that escalatory ladder. So what do you do? Khan said, first of all, understand that's what you're doing. Two, take a beat. And three, de-escalate. Climb back down the ladder. And that's what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there are a number of other examples. It's kind of frightening how many, but there are two others I point to in the book. One was in the early 1980s during the Reagan administration. The KGB actually had artificial intelligence. An early version of it was called V-Ryan, was the name of the system. But what it did, it looked at a long list of factors in the Soviet Union, basically Russia, but the Soviet Union at the time and the United States, GDP, economic growth, inflation, et cetera, a whole bunch of things, and basically looked at how the U.S. was increasing the power over the Soviet Union. And they looked at the spread, and they said when the spread gets to a certain size, the U.S. may start a nuclear war, meaning if it's close, no way, but if they think they have the edge, here's their chance, they might do it. And the first thing you learn about nuclear war fighting is if you think the other side is going to shoot, you shoot first, because the guy who shoots first wipes out their missiles before they can wipe you out. It's been called two scorpions in a bottle. If one scorpion strikes, but the other scorpion has just enough strength left to strike back and they both die. That's the dynamic. The Soviet Union determined that the U.S. had opened up the spread. It was getting dangerous. Well, NATO, led by the U.S., was doing a war game at the time. And the war game scenario was a nuclear war. They weren't starting a nuclear war, but they were kind of rehearsing or saying, well, what would happen if, or how would you do it? How would you do a nuclear war? And there were heads of state involved and all that. Well, the KGB is watching this, but they didn't know it was a war game. They said, hey, they're getting ready to do exactly what we thought they were going to do. And it was dangerously close to World War III, nuclear annihilation. And it was a U.S. lieutenant general who saw this and said, this is contrary to his orders. He ordered NATO to dial it down. He said, basically de-escalate our own war game as a way of signaling to the Soviet Union that this is not real. The Soviet Union got the message and they de-escalated. We narrowly avoided it. There was another case where a Soviet system, again, this is primitive AI, and primitive by today's standards, but it was AI, where a system gave a launch signal to a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet army. It said, launch the missiles, because we see incoming U.S. nuclear missiles, and they have the doctrines launch on warning. When you see them coming in, you launch your stuff right away. You don't wait to get hit. But this particular lieutenant colonel had worked on the system, and he knew it was a little funky. And his orders were call your seniors, and that was escalate, and then they probably would have fired the missiles. Who wants to be the one who says don't fire when you're about to get, destroyed? But he didn't. He disobeyed orders. He basically bet his country, the entire Soviet Union, on his hunch. I'll come back to the hunch because that's important. On his hunch that there was something wrong with the system, that it was not a nuclear attack. And in particular, they saw five missiles coming in. He said, now, if they're attacking, they'll use 100, not five. Well, it turns out that the system had picked up reflections of the sun in such a way that those reflections look like dots, incoming missiles, etc. And he was later known as the man who saved the world. But here's my point. Both the lieutenant general in the U.S. and the lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Union disobeyed standard operating procedures and their orders, and separately, in two cases, may have saved the world from nuclear annihilation. What is that? Well, it's gut instinct, it's common sense, it's intuition, it's a lot of things, but you're betting your country that you're right. Here's the problem, and sorry to be long-winded, but I'll kind of bring this all together. AI cannot do that. AI can do deductive logic. Deduction is, major premise, minor premise, conclusion, et cetera. There are flaws in it if the major premise is wrong, but it's a kind of logic that works going back to Aristotle. Inductive logic is you just have a whole bunch of cases. You see something everywhere and you draw the inference, well, this must be the way it is, or this must be right because I see it everywhere. Although it took a long time for Europeans to find a black swan. They're down in Adelaide, in Australia. I've been there. I've seen them. But people didn't know that. Westerners at least didn't know that for a long time. So computers can do deductive logic and inductive logic. But there's a third branch of logic that very few people understand called abductive logic. And this was outlined by Charles Sanders Peirce in the 19th century. He's an interesting guy because he was 100 years ahead of his time. So the problem with people like that, it takes 100 years before you can look back and say, hey, he was right. This is probably abductive logic. He was the father of semiotics, which is kind of the cornerstone of philosophy today. But the point is, you can't program it. If I'm trying to summarize it as opposed to presenting a lecture on abductive logic, it's common sense, it's intuition, it's the way you and I get through the day, or humans have got through the day for all of civilization. But you can't program it. And which means if you put artificial intelligence and GPT in the nuclear kill chain and things start escalating, they're going to keep escalating. It's exactly like, you know, all sellers, no buyers, sell everything, get cash, go to the sidelines, except we're talking about nuclear war fighting, where they say escalate, because they're escalating, keep escalating. AI cannot override itself. In other words, it doesn't have common sense. It just has math. So these are the dangers. And I don't say, you know, go live in a cave with a machine gun and canned goods or whatever. There are things we can do about it. And I never point to problems without pointing to solutions. And the solution in nuclear war fighting is don't put AI in the kill chain. If you want to have it over here as a research tool, okay, think hard about that. But it's already there. The Chinese are building it. The U.S. is too. But don't put it in the decision-making chain, because it will lack the ability to de-escalate and back off when the time comes, which has saved the world in a couple instances, and I talk about them in the book. Getting back to stock markets and the, you know, the fallacy of composition, sell, 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 no buyers, how do you deal with that? There is a field called cybernetics, and it comes from a Greek word, but when you go to the Greek origin, cybernetics means the helmsman, who's steering the boat. That's the literal meaning from ancient Greek language. And what it means is, again, the metaphors are helpful. Let's say you're driving on a sheet of ice and something happened, you slam on the brakes. What's going to happen to the car? It's not going to stop. It's going to keep going. It might start spinning around. Who knows what it's going to hit? But the car is going to go out of control. What if you're on ice? I live in the mountains, by the way, so I'm used to driving on ice. What you have to do is tap the brakes. Don't slam the brake. Tap, tap, tap. Slow it down a little. Keep two hands on the wheel and hopefully it stays under control. That's an example of the helmsman, the driver in this case, or what's known as cybernetics. So what it would say is, instead of shutting the stock market with circuit breakers, which could make the panic worse, why don't we throttle the order flow? So if you see a lot of sell orders coming in, just say, all right, we're only going to execute half those orders. The other half, just going to get in the queue, wait your turn. And then if it gets worse, all right, well, now we're going to execute 10% of those orders. And I was give the buy side, throttle the sellers on purpose and, you know, be upfront about it. Throttle the sellers and give the buyers a chance to think and catch up before everything falls apart. There are other solutions in the book, but that's where I think cybernetics can play a role to temper the extremes of artificial intelligence.
Well, Jim, first off, I just want to say, I feel like I'm in one of your classes and I'm receiving a lecture on a topic that I've not been exposed to in a long time. So I do appreciate hearing that and knowing about this history about how close we came because of a technological error that showcased something that could have annihilated the world just shows how big of a risk that is. And what somewhat, maybe I would use the word terrifies me, is the speed of how things happen now is like, you know, I could even just think of that in a conversation. It's like somebody writes me an email, a very long-winded email. You can just put it in ChatGPT, say, give me a response, and you can respond immediately. But I haven't even taken the time to integrate what it was. It was just done automatically. I'm not really owning the response. There's a lot of things that I'm just, it's almost like a dashboard is only as good as how great you can go into the back end and see what is behind driving what's on the dashboard, or else you actually don't have any intelligence yourself. And I feel like we are in a collective journey towards deluding ourselves that by trusting artificial intelligence, things are better. But I feel like we're all going to get really dumb and lose faith on any dashboard we see or any information being shared, because it's all being done with no one at the end of the day actually understanding what's going on. So it's almost like a drive to idiocracy, which can lead to these national security risks, to these, you know, hyper impulsive triggers on the stock market. And then I can't even imagine on the workforce space is like, hey, we can eliminate a bunch of jobs, so let's just get AI to do everything. And then only to realize, hey, nobody actually knows what this thing is doing, why it's doing it. It almost gets lost. And the miracle and even the enthusiasm that I came starting this call, it's almost like, hold on, maybe we need to slow down and figure out what the hell is going on here, because I don't think that space is being created.
Well, first of all, Justin, you're exactly right. And there's a lot of it's not just an opinion. It was a very good description. There's a lot of evidence to back that up. I'll give you a concrete example. It's very fresh and it's in the book. So Google had an AI, but GPT, which is a branch of AI. GPT is the one that you can ask a question. It'll give you a written essay. It'll give you pictures. It'll do your homework for you or write a book if you wanted to. And somebody said, okay, they're using this. And they said, show me a picture of a pope, you know, lead bishop of the Catholic Church, 2,000 years. And the response had a number of women in papal vestments. And this was the answer to show me a picture of a pope. And, well, in 2,000 years, there have been 266 popes, no women. Now, if you want to have a debate about female priests, that's a fair debate. I leave that to others, but it's a fact that there has never been a female pope. But the Google system was producing female popes. Somebody said, the prompt is the question, give me a picture of a Viking. And it came back with black Vikings. And if you've ever been to Norway, they're all, you know, pretty white and pretty blonde. It's not a racial thing. It's just a fact. There are no black Vikings, or there were no black Vikings. So everyone's like, well, what's up with that? This thing's malfunctioning. Well, it turns out that Google was using something called prompt injection. Everyone's like, oh, the system malfunctioned. No, the system did not malfunction. And that's the point I make. It worked exactly as intended. But the prompt injection means you ask it a question. It then alters your question to reflect a bias or a preference or something that Google wishes would happen. So, for example, when you say, show me a picture of a pope, the system reads, show me a picture of a pope in a world of diversity, equity, and inclusion where, you know, all genders are treated equally. Well, if you ask that question, you're going to get a female pope. And same thing, show me a picture of a Viking in a world where everyone, you know, gets the same chance to, you know, wear a helmet with horns, you're going to get a black Viking. So the point is, it wasn't a malfunction. The Google programmers behind the curtain, exactly what you were describing, you know, just take it down a couple levels, were altering the prompts to produce a result that corresponded with their preference of the kind of world they would like to see. Now, I happen to know a lot about the Catholic Church and know a little bit less about Vikings, I guess, but I know there's never been a female pope. I know there were no black Vikings. As a subject matter expert, I can look at the output and say, well, that's garbage. That's not true. And this is to your point, Jason. If you have to be a subject matter expert to spot the flaws in the GPT output, what good is it in the first place if they're playing all kinds of games behind the curtain? There was another guy who said, give me a biography of, and he put in his own name. You know, the computer didn't know who he was, but give me a biography of fill in the blank. And it was the guy who was asking the question. Well, the GPT came back with a real pretty good biography, you know, born such and such a day, did this, did that, you know, went to college, whatever. And at the end, it said he died in 2019. And so then the writer said, well, okay, let's keep going. What did he die of? Well, the computer came back with an answer and on and on and on. It turns out, of course, that was all invented, right? They call it hallucinations, or I call it confabulation, same thing. It turns out that the guy asking the question was the obituary writer for The Telegraph, for the newspaper in the UK. And the computer saw his name in 1,000 obituaries. So he said, he must be dead. Well, he wasn't dead. He was the obituary writer. But I label this the puppy theory. And the puppy theory is, let's say you have a puppy and you're training the puppy to fetch a ball. You throw the ball. Let's say the puppy does it, brings it back. Well, you give him a pat on the head or a doggy treat or something, and, you know, you kind of encourage the behavior. GPT wants to keep you happy. It's like a puppy that wants to, you know, please the master, and it will completely invent things, fill in the blanks out of its own imagination. It's not really imagining. Again, it's all math. Like, bear that in mind. So these, you know, college kids are asking GPT to write their essays. It will, but don't be surprised if the professor gives you an F, because it's not even plagiarism, because they're making it up, but it's invention and it's not factual, and an expert's going to spot that. So again, I'm not bashing AI. I'm not bashing GPT. I'm just saying they're full of flaws, full of biases. They can be used for censorship, and they are being used for censorship, and full of dangers in the nuclear war fighting example, and full of financial risks in the example I gave you when we turn over the trading to AI and it takes the market straight down. So on that cheery note, I hope people enjoy the book. But I do, first of all, keep it in plain English. I don't dumb it down, but I avoid the jargon. Two, try to, you know, point to the dangers and help people prepare. There are things you can do, by the way. I'm not a gold bug, but, you know, having land, gold, silver, fine art, those are all non-digital assets that AI can't touch. So have some of that in your portfolio in case these other things happen. And then three, I do give some concrete solutions, but I hope people enjoy it.
I think people will absolutely enjoy it. Jim, it's such a pleasure to have a conversation with you. This is something that I'm hoping is going to get people enough curiosity to realize that this is something serious to consider, something that you've put in the research so people know how to prepare, especially as we see AI can pose a threat to the global economy. And of course, it's not about doom and gloom. It's about be aware of what's going on and then take the actions necessary so that you don't get part of the cycle at the same time. I do have to ask you a question, which I do ask all my guests here, which might come into left field, but I really hope you can give me a good answer here, which is you're on the Selling with Love podcast. And I'd be curious to know, what does selling with love mean to you?
Well, I put the emphasis on the word love. We, you know, if we're in commerce or business, when people ask me, say, well, Jim, what's it like to write a book? And I say, well, writing is hard and selling is harder, you know, because there are a lot of books out there. So we kind of all know what selling is, but I think it's important to keep love in mind, you know, in interacting with people. In, you know, hopefully in my book, it's not just warnings, it has solutions. It's not just, hey, get out of the stock market. Say, hey, you know, trade some stocks, but, you know, maybe a little gold on the side, a slice of that, you know, won't do you any harm. Look out for your family. And I say over and over, the solution to societal collapse or breakdown, and these things happen. I mean, you go back enough history, they happen over and over again, is not living in a cave, it's living in a community. In other words, maybe on a much smaller scale. That's how complex systems collapse. They basically descale themselves. So instead of a nation where, and any nation in the world, where they're telling you what to do, where everyone's relying on the central power to do everything, you want to be in a community where, you know, maybe the carpenter can fix your deck and you're a plumber and you can do something for him, or you're a doctor and people share expertise on a small scale. Well, that's all based on love. If you don't love people, if you don't trust people, that's not going to work. But often it does. And that's one way to think about how to get through crises, how to get through disasters, is you descale and rely on your community.
Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time, for your sharing, for all of the work that you've put in keeping people informed on how to manage money, how to navigate crises, how to anticipate latest trends and make sure we come out on the other side with our shirts still on our backs. Best of luck on the book launch. Also, for everybody listening to this, Money GPT AI and the Threat to the Global Economy, we're putting a link into the show notes for you to go dive deeper on all the things that are on the way, happening right now, actually, and pick up a copy if it's not out yet, since it's coming out on the 12th of November. And if you're listening to this episode and it's past that date, then you can pick it up now. Grab it on all the major publisher platforms, including Amazon. You can get e-copies as well. Jim, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. For me, this was such a fun digestion of something that's outside of the norm on the podcast, but so relevant to what we're navigating today. And I'm so grateful to have you on the show.
Thanks.
I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Hola mi gente, Rosalind Sanchez here from He Said, Ella Dijo. And although I like drama in my telenovelas, when it comes to real life, I prefer a drama-free casa. Thanks to Fabuloso, its remarkable lavender scent lingers like a longing glance. And with 2 times more active ingredients to take the drama out of any mess, you'll be shouting gracias. Fabuloso's 2x concentrator formula provides 2x more active cleaning ingredients versus non-concentrated Fabuloso original. Use as directed.